This is tape 4, side 2, The Century of Light, continuing from page 119. The crisis roused the Baha'i world to extraordinary feats of achievement. National spiritual assemblies who had little or no experience in developing a working relationship with officials of their country's governments were called on to solicit government support for resolutions at various levels of the international human rights system, and did so with outstanding success. Year after year, for 20 uninterrupted years, the case of the Iranian Baha'is proceeded through the international human rights system, gathering support in successive resolutions, ensuring attention to Baha'i grievances in the missions of rapporteurs appointed by the United Nations Human Rights Commission, and consolidating these gains through decisions of the Third Committee of the United Nations General Assembly. Every attempt by the Iranian regime to escape international condemnation of its treatment of its Baha'i citizens failed to shake the support the Baha'i issue attracted from a persistent majority of sympathetic nations represented on the commission. Page 120. The achievement was all the more remarkable in the context of the Commission's constantly changing membership and a demanding agenda that included human rights abuses in other countries that affected millions of victims. At the same time, as direct pressure was being exerted on the Iranian government, the case was attracting unprecedented publicity around the world in newspapers, magazines, and the broadcast media. Newspapers such as the New York Times, Le Monde, and Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, enjoying international readership, gave wide coverage to the persecution and television networks in Australia, Canada, the United States, and a number of European countries produced in-depth magazine format presentations. The abuses were denounced in often strong editorial comment. Apart from the support thus lent to the efforts to secure effective intervention at the Human Rights Commission, such publicity had the effect of introducing, usually for the first time, and to an audience of tens of millions of people, accurate and appreciative information about Baha'i teachings and belief. Both the publicity and the campaign being carried on through the United Nations system provided influential officials around the world with a sustained opportunity to judge for themselves both the teachings of the cause and the character of the Baha'i community. A problem arising out of the persecution was that faced by several thousand Iranian Baha'is who found themselves either stranded without valid passports in countries where they were serving as pioneers, or forced to flee from Iran because they or their families had been singled out as targets of the pogrom. In 1983, an international Baha'i refugee office was established in Canada, where the government had been particularly responsive to the representations made by the National Spiritual Assembly of that country. Footnote on Baha'i refugee office established in Canada. During the 9 years of its existence, the office was responsible for settling an estimated 10,000 Iranian Baha'i refugees in 27 countries. End of footnote. Over the next few years, with the assistance of the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, a series of other countries likewise opened their doors to more than 10,000 Iranian Baha'is, many of whom filled pioneer goals in their new places of residence. Page 121. Not only the Baha'i community, but the United Nations human rights system itself benefited from this long struggle. Initially, after the Islamic Revolution, the community of believers in Iran had faced a threat to its very survival. In time, the United Nations Human Rights Commission, however slow and relatively cumbersome its operations may appear to some outside observers, succeeded in compelling the Iranian regime to bring the worst of the persecutions to a halt. In this way, the case of Iran's Baha'is marked a significant victory for the Commission and the Baha'i faith alike. It served as a startling demonstration of the power of community of nations acting through the machinery created for the purpose to bring under control patterns of oppression that had darkened the pages of recorded history throughout the ages. This circumstance highlights the relevance of the faith's activities to the life of the larger society in which these efforts are taking place. together with world peace, the need for the international community to take effective steps to realize the ideals in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and its related covenants is an urgent challenge facing humanity at the present moment in its history. There are relatively few places in the world where minority populations, because of religious, ethnic, or national prejudices, are not still denied basic human needs of some kind. No body of people on the planet understands better this issue than does the Baha'i community. It has endured, continues to endure in some lands, mistreatment for which there is no conceivable justification, whether legal or moral. It has given its martyrs and shed its tears, while remaining faithful to its conviction that hatred and retaliation are corrosive to the soul. And it has learned, as few communities have done, how to use the United Nations human rights system in the manner intended by that system's creators, without having recourse to involvement in political partisanship of any kind, much less violence. Drawing on this experience, it is today embarked on a program to encourage governments in a score of countries to institute public education programs on the subject of human rights, providing whatever practical assistance of its own is possible. Page 122. Footnote. To date, 99 National Spiritual Assemblies have received intensive training in the program. End of footnote. Throughout the world, it is particularly active in promoting the rights of women and children. Most important of all, it provides a living example of brotherhood from which countless people outside its embrace derive courage and hope. As the Iranian crisis was unfolding, an initiative taken by the Universal House of Justice suddenly moved the external affairs work of the Baha'i community to an entirely new level. In 1985, the statement, "The Promise of World Peace," addressed to the generality of humankind, was released through National Spiritual Assemblies. In it, the House of Justice asserted, in unprovocative but uncompromising terms, Baha'i confidence in the advent of international peace as the next stage in the evolution of society. Set out, as well, were elements of the form that this long-awaited development must take, many of which went far beyond the political terms in which the subject is commonly discussed. It concluded, quote, "The experience of the Baha'i community may be seen as an example of this enlarging unity of humankind. If the Baha'i experience can contribute in whatever measure to reinforcing hope in the unity of the human race, we are happy to offer it as a model for study," end quote. While the immediate purpose of the release was to provide Baha'i institutions and individual believers with a coherent line of discussion for their interactions with government authorities, organizations of civil society, the media, and influential personalities, a collateral effect was to set in motion an intensive and ongoing education of the Baha'i community itself in several important Baha'i teachings. The influence of the ideas and perspectives in the document was soon making itself widely felt in conventions, publications, summer and winter schools, and the general discourse of believers everywhere. In many respects, the promise of world peace may be said to have set the agenda for Baha'i interaction with the United Nations and its attendant organizations in the years since 1985. Page 123. Building on the reputation it had already won, the Baha'i international community became, in only a few short years, one of the most influential of the non-governmental organizations. Because it is, and is seen to be, entirely non-partisan, it has increasingly been trusted as a mediating voice in complex and often stressful discussions in international circles on major issues of social progress. This reputation has been strengthened by appreciation of the fact that the community refrains, on principle, from taking advantage of such trust to press partisan agendas of its own. By 1968, the Baha'i representative had been elected to membership on the executive committee of non-governmental organizations, subsequently holding the positions of chairman and vice chairman. From this point on, representatives of the community found themselves increasingly asked to function as conveners or chairpersons of a wide range of bodies, committees, task force, working groups, and advisory boards. During the past 4 years, the community's principal representative has served as executive secretary of the Conference of Non-Governmental Organizations, the central coordinating body of non-governmental groups affiliated with the United Nations. The structure of the Baha'i International Community reflects the principles guiding its work. It has escaped labeling as merely another special interest lobby group, while making full use of the expertise and executive resources of its United Nations Office and Office of Public Information, the community has come to be recognized by its fellow non-governmental organizations as essentially an association of democratically elected national councils representative of a cross-section of humankind. Baha'i delegations to international events commonly include members appointed by various national spiritual assemblies who are experienced in the subject matters under discussion and who can provide regional perspectives. This feature of the faith's involvement in the life of society, in which motivating principle and operating method represent two dimensions of a unified approach to issues, demonstrated its power at the series of world summits and related conferences organized by the United Nations held between 1990 and 1996. In that period of nearly 6 years, the political leaders of the world came together repeatedly under the aegis of the Secretary General of the United Nations to discuss the major challenges facing humankind as the 20th century drew to a close. Page 124. No Baha'i can review the themes of these historic gatherings without being struck by how closely the agenda mirrored major teachings of Baha'u'llah. It seemed befitting that the centenary of his ascension should occur at the midway point in the process, endowing the meetings for Baha'is with spiritual meaning beyond merely their stated goals. Among those gatherings, the World Conference on Education for All in Thailand, 1990, the World Summit for Children in New York, 1990, the United Nations Conference on the Environment in Rio de Janeiro, 1992, an anguished and chaotic World Conference on Human Rights in Vienna, 1993, the International Conference on Population in Cairo, 1994, the World Summit for Social Development in Copenhagen, 1995, and the particularly vibrant Fourth World Conference on Women in Beijing, 1995, stand out as highlights of this process of global discourse on the problems afflicting the world's peoples. Footnote on Fourth World Conference on Women in Beijing. The Beijing Conference on Women would have permitted 50 out of the 2,000 non-governmental organizations involved to present their statements orally. Because the Baha'i international community had received this privilege at previous conferences, most notably that in Rio de Janeiro on the environment and that in Copenhagen on social and economic development, the community's representative yielded the slot that had been accorded them in favor of the Moscow Center for Gender Studies. End of footnote. At the concurrent non-governmental conferences, Baha'i delegations, made up of members from a wide range of countries, had the opportunity to place issues in a spiritual as well as social perspective. Evidence of the trust the community enjoys among hundreds of its fellow non-governmental organizations was the fact that Baha'i delegations were repeatedly selected by their peers for inclusion among the handful of member groups to be accorded the much-prized opportunity to address the conferences from the podium, rather than merely distributing printed copies of presentations. During the century's concluding years, many national spiritual assemblies won impressive victories of their own in the field of external affairs. Two outstanding examples suggest the character and importance of these advances. The first was achieved by the National Spiritual Assembly of Germany, where the nature of Baha'i elected bodies had been challenged by local authorities as being technically incompatible with the requirements of German civil law. Page 125. In upholding the appeal of the local spiritual assembly of the Baha'is of Tübingen against this ruling, Germany's Constitutional High Court concluded that the Baha'i administrative order is an integral feature of the faith and as such is inseparable from Baha'i belief. The High Court justified its taking jurisdiction in the case by adducing evidence that the Baha'i faith itself is a religion, a judgment with far-reaching implications in a society where church opponents have long sought to misrepresent the cause as a cult or sect. The definitive language of the judgment merits repetition. Quote, "The character of the Baha'i faith as a religion and of the Baha'i community as a religious community is evident in actual everyday life, in cultural tradition, and in the understanding of the general public as well as of the science of comparative religion." End of quote. Footnote, a full account including the text of the decision of the German Federal Constitutional Court can be found in the Baha'i World, Volume 20, page 571 through 606. End of footnote. It was left to the Brazilian Baha'i community to win a victory in the field of external affairs that is so far unique in Baha'i history. On 28 May 1992, its country's highest legislative body, the Chamber of Deputies, held a special session to pay tribute to Baha'u'llah on the centenary of his ascension. The speaker read a message from the Universal House of Justice, and representatives of all of the parties rose, one by one, to acknowledge the contribution to human betterment of the faith and its founder. A moving address by one prominent deputy described the Baha'i teachings as, quote, "the most colossal religious work ever written by the pen of a single man," end quote. Footnote, Cesário Solena da Camara Vidala, Brasilia, 28 de Maio, 1992, reprinted with English translation by the National Spiritual Assembly of the Baha'is of Brazil, 1992. End of footnote. Such appreciations of the nature of the cause and of the work it is trying to accomplish, coming as they did from the highest judicial and legislative levels, respectively, of two of the world's major nations, were victories of the spirit as important in their way as those won in the teaching field. They helped to open those doors through which Baha'u'llah's healing influence begins to touch the life of society itself. Page 27, Chapter 11. The image used by Abdu'l-Bahá to capture for his hearers the coming transformation of society was that of light. Unity, he declared, is the power that illuminates and advances all forms of human endeavor. The age that was opening would come in the future to be regarded as the century of light, because in it universal recognition of the oneness of humankind would be achieved. With this foundation in place, the process of building a global society embodying principles of justice will begin. The vision was enunciated by the Master in several tablets and addresses. Its fullest expression occurs in a tablet addressed by Abdu'l-Bahá to Jane Elizabeth White, wife of the former moderator of the Free Church of Scotland. Mrs. White was an ardent sympathizer of the Baha'i teachings, had visited the Master in Akka, and would later make arrangements for the particularly warm reception that met him in Edinburgh. Using the familiar metaphor of candles, Abdu'l-Bahá wrote to Mrs. White, quote, "O honored lady, behold how its unity light is now dawning upon the world's darkened horizon. The first candle is unity in the political realm, the early glimmerings of which can now be discerned. The second candle is unity of thought in world undertakings, the consummation of which will ere long be witnessed." Page 128. "The third candle is unity in freedom, which will surely come to pass. The fourth candle is unity in religion, which is the cornerstone of the foundation itself, and which by the power of God will be revealed in all its splendor. The fifth candle is the unity of nations, a unity which in this century will be securely established, causing all the peoples of the world to regard themselves as citizens of one common fatherland. The sixth candle is unity of races, making of all that dwell on earth peoples and kindreds of one race. The seventh candle is unity of language, that is, the choice of a universal tongue in which all peoples will be instructed and converse. Each and every one of these will inevitably come to pass, inasmuch as the power of the kingdom of God will aid and assist in their realization." End quote. Selections from the writings of Abdu'l-Bahá, pages 34-36. While it will be decades, or perhaps a great deal longer, before the vision contained in this remarkable document is fully realized. The essential features of what it promised are now established facts throughout the world. In several of the great changes envisioned, unity of race and unity of religion, the intent of the Master's words is clear and the processes involved are far advanced, however great may be the resistance in some quarters. To a large extent, this is also true of unity of language. The need for it is now recognized on all sides, as reflected in the circumstances that have compelled the United Nations and much of the non-governmental community to adopt several official languages. Until a decision is taken by international agreement, the effect of such developments as the Internet, the management of air traffic, the development of technological vocabularies of various kinds, and universal education itself, has been to make it possible, to some extent, for English to fill the gap. Unity of thought in world undertakings, a concept for which the most idealistic aspirations at the opening of the 20th century lacked even reference points, is also in large measure everywhere apparent in vast programs of social and economic development, humanitarian aid, and concern for protection of the environment of the planet and its oceans. As to unity in the political realm, Shoghi Effendi has explained that the reference is to unity which sovereign states achieve among themselves, a developing process the present stage of which is the establishment of the United Nations, page 129. The Master's promise of unity of nations, on the other hand, looked forward to today's widespread acceptance among the peoples of the world of the fact that, however great the differences among them may be, they are the inhabitants of a single global homeland. Unity and freedom has today, of course, become a universal aspiration of the Earth's inhabitants. Among the chief developments giving substance to it, the Master may well have had in mind the dramatic extinction of colonialism and the consequent rise of self-determination as a dominant feature of the national identity at century's end. Whatever threats still hang over humanity's future, the world has been transformed by the events of the 20th century. That the features of the process should also have been described by the voice that predicted it with such confidence ought to command earnest reflection on the part of serious minds everywhere. The changes wrought in humanity's social and moral life received powerful endorsement at a series of international gatherings called under the United Nations authority to mark the approaching end of one millennium and the beginning of a new one. On 22-26 May 2000, representatives of over 1,000 non-governmental organizations assembled in New York at the invitation of Kofi Annan, the United Nations Secretary General. In the statement that emerged from this meeting, spokespersons of civil society committed their organizations to the ideal that, quote, "We are one human family in all our diversity, living on one common homeland and sharing a just, sustainable, and peaceful world guided by universal principles of democracy." End quote. United Nations General Assembly 54th Session Agenda Item 49B, United Nations Reform Measures and Proposals, the Millennium Assembly of the United Nations, 8 August 2000. Document number A/54/959, page 2. Shortly afterwards, from 28-31 August 2000, a record gathering brought together leaders of most of the world's religious communities, likewise assembled at the United Nations headquarters. The Baha'i international community was represented by a secretary general, who addressed one of the plenary sessions, page 130. No observer could fail to be struck by the call of the world's religious leaders formally for their countries to respect the right to freedom of religion, to seek reconciliation, and to engage in mutual forgiveness and healing. Footnote, see Commitment to Global Peace, Declaration of the Millennial World Peace Summit of Religious and Spiritual Leaders, presented to UN Secretary General Kofi Annan on 29 August 2000 during a summit session at the UN General Assembly. End of footnote. These two preliminary events prepared the way for what had been designated as the Millennium Summit itself, meeting at the United Nations headquarters from 6 to 8 September 2000. bringing together 149 heads of state and government, the consultation sought to give hope and assurance to the populations of the nations represented. The summit took the welcome step of inviting a spokesman for the forum of non-governmental organizations to share the concerns that had been identified at that preparatory gathering. It seemed to Baha'is as significant as it was gratifying that the individual accorded this high honor was the Baha'i International Community's principal representative to the United Nations in his capacity as co-chairman of the forum. Nothing so dramatically illustrates the difference between the world of 1900 and that of 2000 than the text of the summit resolution signed by all the participants and referred by them to the United Nations General Assembly. Quote, "We solemnly reaffirm on this historic occasion that the United Nations is the indispensable common house of the entire human family, through which we will seek to realize our universal aspirations for peace, cooperation, and development. We therefore pledge our unstinting support for these common objectives and our determination to achieve them." End quote. United Nations General Assembly, 54th Session, Agenda 61B, the Millennium Assembly of the United Nations, 8 September 2000, Section 32. In concluding this sequence of historic meetings, Mr. Annan addressed himself to the assembled world leaders in surprisingly candid terms, terms that, for many Baha'is, carried echoes of Baha'u'llah's stern admonition to the now vanquished kings and emperors who had been these leaders' predecessors. Quote, "It lies in your power, and therefore it is your responsibility, to reach the goals that you have defined. Only you can determine whether the United Nations rises to the challenge." End quote. Footnote, the respective purposes of the three millennium gatherings, as well as the involvement of the Baha'i community in these meetings, were summarized in a letter from the Universal House of Justice to all national spiritual assemblies, dated 24 September 2000. End of footnote. Page 131. Despite the historic importance of the meetings and the fact that the greater portion of humanity's political, civil, and religious leadership took part, the Millennium Summit made little impression on the public mind in most countries. Generous media attention was given to certain of the events, but few readers or listeners could fail to note the expression of skepticism that characterized the editorial treatment of the subject or the air of doubt, even of cynicism, that crept into many of the news stories themselves. The sharp disjunction between an event that could legitimately claim to mark a major turning point in human history, on the one hand, and the lack of enthusiasm or even interest it aroused among populations who were its supposed beneficiaries, on the other, was perhaps the most striking feature of the Millennium Observations. It exposed the depth of the crisis the world is experiencing at century's end, in which the processes of both integration and disintegration that had gathered momentum during the past 100 years seemed to accelerate with each passing day. Those who long to believe the visionary statements of world leaders struggle at the same time in the grip of two phenomena that undermine such confidence. The first has already been considered at some length in these pages. The collapse of society's moral foundations has left the greater part of humankind floundering without reference points in a world that grows daily more threatening and unpredictable. To suggest that the process has nearly reached its end would be merely to raise false hopes. One may appreciate that intense political efforts are being made, that impressive scientific advances continue, or that economic conditions improve for a portion of humankind, all without seeing in such developments anything resembling hope of a secure life for oneself, or more importantly, for one's children. The sense of disillusionment which, as Shoghi Effendi warned, the spread of political corruption would create in the minds of the mass of humankind is now widespread. Outbreaks of lawlessness have become pandemic in both urban and rural life in many lands. The failure of social controls, the effort to justify the most extreme forms of aberrant behavior as primarily civil rights issues, and an almost universal celebration in the arts and media of degeneracy and violence. Page 132. These and similar manifestations of a condition approaching moral anarchy suggest a future that paralyzes the imagination. Against the background of this desolate landscape, the intellectual vogue of the age, seeking to make a virtue out of grim necessity, has adopted for itself the appellation and mission of deconstructionism. The second of the two developments undermining faith in the future was the focus of some of the Millennium Summit's most anguished debates. The information revolution, set off in the closing decade of the century by the invention of the World Wide Web, transformed irreversibly much of human activity. The process of globalization that had been following a long rising curve over a period of several centuries was galvanized by new powers beyond the imaginations of most people. Economic forces, breaking free of traditional restraints, brought into being during the closing decade of the century a new global order in the designing, generation, and distribution of wealth. Knowledge itself became a significantly more valuable commodity than even financial capital and material resources. In a breathtakingly short space of time, national borders, already under assault, became permeable, with the result that vast sums now pass instantly through them at the command of a computer signal. Complex production operations are so reconfigured as to integrate and maximize the economies available from the contributions of a range of specializing participants without regard to their national locations. If one were to lower one's horizon to purely material considerations, the Earth has already taken on something of the character of one country, and the inhabitants of various lands the status of its consumer citizens. Nor is the transformation merely economic. Increasingly, globalization assumes political, social, and cultural dimensions. It has become clear that the powers of the institution of the nation-state, once the arbiter and protector of humanity's fortunes, has been drastically eroded. While national governments continue to play a crucial role, they must now make room for such rising centers of power as multinational corporations, United Nations agencies, non-governmental organizations of every kind, and huge media conglomerates, the cooperation of all of which is vital to the success of most programs aimed at achieving significant economic or social ends. Page 133. Just as the migration of money or corporations encounters little hindrance from national borders, neither can the latter any longer exercise effective control over the dissemination of knowledge. Internet communication, which has the ability to transmit in seconds the entire contents of libraries that took centuries of study to amass, vastly enriches the intellectual life of anyone able to use it, as well as providing sophisticated training in a broad range of professional fields. The system, so prophetically foreseen 60 years ago by Shoghi Effendi, builds a sense of shared community among its users that is impatient of either geographic or cultural distances. The benefits to many millions of persons are obvious and impressive. Cost-effectiveness resulting from the coordination of formerly competing operations tends to bring goods and services within the reach of populations who could not previously have hoped to enjoy them. Enormous increases in the funds available for research and development expand the variety and quality of such benefits. Something of a leveling effect in the distribution of employment opportunities can be seen in the ease with which business operations can shift their base from one part of the world to another. The abandonment of barriers to transnational trade reduces still further the cost of goods to consumers. It is not difficult to appreciate, from a Baha'i perspective, the potentiality of such transformations for laying the foundation of the global society envisioned in Baha'u'llah's writings. Far from inspiring optimism about the future, however, globalization is seen by large and growing numbers of people around the world as the principal threat to that future. The violence of the riots set off by the meetings of the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, and the International Monetary Fund during the last 2 years testifies to the depth of the fear and resentment that the rise of globalization has provoked. Media coverage of these unexpected outbursts focused public attention on protests against gross disparities in the distribution of benefits and opportunities, which globalization is seen as only increasing, and on warnings that, if effective controls are not speedily imposed, the consequences will be catastrophic in social and political, as well as in economic and environmental terms. page 134. Such concerns appear well-founded. Economic statistics alone reveal a picture of current global conditions that is profoundly disturbing. The ever-widening gulf between the one-fifth of the world's population living in the highest income countries and the one-fifth living in the lowest income countries tells a grim story. According to the 1999 Human Development Report published by the United Nations Development Program, this gap represented in 1990 a ratio of 60 to 1. That is to say, one segment of humankind was enjoying access to 60% of the world's wealth, while another equally large population struggled merely to survive on barely 1% of that wealth. By 1997, in the wake of globalization's rapid advance, the gulf had widened in only 7 years to a ratio of 74 to 1. Even this appalling fact does not take into account the steady impoverishment of the majority of the remaining billions of human beings trapped in the relentlessly narrowing isthmus between these two extremes. Far from being brought under control, the crisis is clearly accelerating. The implications for humanity's future in terms of privation and despair engulfing more than two-thirds of the Earth's population help to account for the apathy that met the Millennium Summit celebration of achievements that were, by every reasonable criteria, truly historic. Globalization itself is an intrinsic feature of the evolution of human society. It has brought into existence a socio-economic culture that, at the practical level, constitutes the world in which the aspirations of the human race will be pursued in the century now opening. No objective observer, if he is fair-minded in his judgment, will deny that both of the two contradictory reactions it is arousing are, in large measure, well justified. The unification of human society, forged by the fires of the 20th century, is a reality that with every passing day opens breathtaking new possibilities. A reality also being forced on serious minds everywhere is the claim of justice to be the one means capable of harnessing these great potentialities to the advancement of civilization. It no longer requires the gift of prophecy to realize that the fate of humanity in the century now opening will be determined by the relationship established between these two fundamental forces of the historical process, the inseparable principles of unity and justice. Page 135. In the perspective of Baha'i teachings, the greatest danger of both the moral crisis and the inequities associated with globalization in its current form is an entrenched philosophical attitude that seeks to justify and excuse these failures. The overthrow of the 20th century's totalitarian systems has not meant the end of ideology. On the contrary, there has not been a society in the history of the world, no matter how pragmatic, experimentalist, and multiform it may have been, that did not derive its thrust from some foundational interpretation of reality. Such a system of thought reigns today virtually unchallenged across the planet, under the nominal designation Western civilization. Philosophically and politically, it presents itself as a kind of liberal relativism, economically and socially as capitalism, two value systems that have now so adjusted to each other and become so mutually reinforcing as to constitute virtually a single comprehensive worldview. Appreciation of the benefits in terms of the personal freedom, social prosperity, and scientific progress enjoyed by a significant minority of the Earth's people cannot withhold a thinking person from recognizing that the system is morally and intellectually bankrupt. It has contributed its best to the advancement of civilization, as did all its predecessors, and, like them, is impotent to deal with the needs of the world, never imagined by the 18th century prophets who conceived most of its component elements. Shoghi Effendi did not limit his attention to divine right monarchies, established churches, or totalitarian ideologies when he posed the searching question, quote, "Why should these, in a world subject to the immutable law of change and decay, be exempt from the deterioration that must needs overtake every human institution?" End quote. World Order Baha'u'llah, page 42. Baha'u'llah urges those who believe in him to, quote, see with thine own eyes and not through the eyes of others, end quote, to know thine own knowledge and not through the knowledge of thy neighbor, 136. Tragically, what Baha'is see in present-day society is unbridled exploitation of the masses of humanity by greed that excuses itself as the operation of impersonal market forces. What meets their eyes everywhere is the destruction of moral foundations vital to humanity's future through gross self-indulgence masquerading as freedom of speech. What they find themselves struggling against daily is the pressure of a dogmatic materialism claiming to be the voice of science that seeks systematically to exclude from intellectual life all impulses arising from the spiritual level of human consciousness. And for a Baha'i, the ultimate issues are spiritual. The cause is not a political party nor an ideology, much less an engine for political agitation against this or that social wrong. The process of transformation it has set in motion advances by inducing a fundamental change of consciousness, and the challenge it poses to everyone who would serve it is to free oneself from attachment to inherited assumptions and preferences that are irreconcilable with the will of God for humanity's coming of age. Paradoxically, even the distress caused by prevailing conditions that violate one's conscience aids in this process of spiritual liberation. In the final analysis, such disillusionment drives a Baha'i to confront a truth emphasized over and over again in the writings of the faith. Quote, He hath chosen out of the whole world the hearts of his servants, and made them each a seat for the revelation of his glory. Wherefore, sanctify them from every defilement, that the things for which they were created may be engraven upon them. End quote. Gleanings from the Writings of Baha'u'llah, page 297. This is the end of side 2, tape 4, ending on page 136. Please go to tape 5 for continuation and conclusion of this book.